Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. Coming up in just a bit, we'll head to Dagsborough, Delaware, to learn how a major decision in Hollywood has forced a community landmark to fight for its survival. But earlier in the show, we talked about a string of almost 70 arson fires in Accomack County, Virginia over the past 5 months. Well, our next story is also about a destructive fire in Accomack County. This particular fire took place in January at the Adams United Methodist Church in Whitesville. But this fire was apparently not set by the arsonist who's lit so many buildings ablaze. It was an electrical fire. But its impact was no less devastating to the congregation in Adams. The fire destroyed the sanctuary of the 135-year-old church, melting away furniture, stained glass windows, and church records. Local officials say the sanctuary will have to be demolished within a matter of weeks. So with that looming deadline in mind, I visited the site on Wednesday with Reverend Carl Perez, the pastor of Adams United Methodist Church. The church is at the corner of one of the seemingly countless long and winding country roads in Accomack County. The charred remains of this once lovely house of worship are scattered about, and you can see all of the fried pews and burned beams from the road or the neighboring cornfield because about 80% of the roof is now gone. Reverend Perez started by telling me about that night in January when he got the call about the blaze.
I thought, well, it must be something small or maybe just a mistake. By the time I got the road, I could just see smoke, and I thought, okay, just smoke damage. We can handle that. And then when I got to the front part of the steps, and they knocked out the windows to the doors, and just saw the flames just come right out and shoot through the roof. It was just one of those weird feelings of just despair.
How long did the fire go on and rage through the night?
Well, they did about three hours. I think the first hour they were trying the best that they could. They ran out of water. They went back and got more tanks of water. So there was tankers from five fire stations here going back and forth. By the end of the time it was over, we had 5 feet of water stuck in the basement, and it was still blazing. So, and it was ice. So the water was coming out. It was just form into ice. So it was kind of a weird moment.
And, you know, we just walked around the building, and there's a gigantic gaping hole. Almost looks like, you know, a plane flew into it. Talk about just your feelings now, months later, standing here.
I think it still hurts. I think when you've been in the place that you used to go into for 3 years, every single Sunday at 9 o'clock, you get to this site and you just revisit the memories, the fun times, Easter's, Thanksgiving's, Christmas times. You know, and then you look at what you see here, and it sort of just creates just like something's missing. Someone's missing, and that someone is the building. People say the church is the people, and that is true, but the people gather in the building, and so that's one of the things that we sort of are missing.
Certainly, this community has been ravaged by arson fires. This was not, an arson fire. I know officials pretty quickly ruled it out as an arson. Did you think when you got the call that this was, that your church was the victim of an arson?
Oh, yes. We had already started getting into the 30s, as far as 30 fires at that point. So I had automatically thought, you know, when I saw the flames shooting out, I thought someone had to set this. I mean, it was so intense. The bricks burning, the walls being torn down, the roof caving in, it was just seeing all that water going on and it still not being able to calm it. Really made it think of arson, but they ruled it out pretty quickly that it wasn't, that it was electrical. So,
you know, I know this church has been here for more than 100 years in this community. You know, I'm looking and I'm seeing, you know, charred pews and just the old, you know, stained glass that are all covered in ash and soot. You know, tell me about just some of the, you know, historical and you know, valuable things to this congregation that was lost in this fire.
Well, I think the stained glasses are old. They're original, 1925. That was a big hit. They were donated, of course, from family members. Some of the family members are still around. The pews, you can still see some of the little brass markers on those. Mm-hmm. They're given in honor of. The pulpit furniture is the original pulpit furniture from when they got it in 1925. And so that's been very hard for us to look at, especially when the seats are burned and the altar's charred and things like that. That has been kind of hard for us to look at. there's some things that we found that were buried. So we were able to give some of those mementos back to the families that donated them. We had a prayer circle, an altar candle, things like that that we found that we were able to lift up and give back. And another church was able to use our baptism font. So we've been able to utilize that in some other ways.
Is there one thing that, you know, as you walk through what the fire left behind, was there one thing that you found that I guess stands out the most for you, that kind of personifies this unfortunate tragedy?
Well, I think the next day we had snow, and so it was kind of interesting to come back here and look at it through the snow line on here, because the snow had fell into the church and it sort of gave this calm spirit that sort of just sat there. So as I sat into the sanctuary and I overlooked all the damage, you know, just the sense of peace was awesome. And then when I looked over to the left, we had our brass altar candle was still on the altar. It was untouched, and it just had snow just coming off of it. It was frozen in ice, and the snow was on top of it. Wow. So that was kind of a neat kind of image, a fixture in my mind, so that when I left, I felt okay. I could move on. It wasn't something that I had to be stuck with.
But when we walked into the church and up to what was left of Reverend Perez's former pulpit and his former Sunday morning view, the gravity of this unfortunate situation set in once again.
Yeah, very different looking out now.
This was your perspective every Sunday morning?
Every Sunday morning, 9 o'clock, here at 8:50, start at 9 o'clock. Pulpit used to be right here, a chair there. My chair was right there, and the choir was behind me, and the keyboard was there. And we'd have about 20 to 30 people ready to start. And, you know, the first four rows on the left side always filled up first. And then we get stragglers in, and they always sat in the back on the right-hand side. So it was starting to come alive. It was starting to rebuild and regroup, and, you know, something we look forward to every Sunday. And then you wake up every Sunday and you don't have that place to go. You go somewhere else. So it's different.
I mean, looking around now, I mean, there's obviously the gaping hole that, you know, is on the right side towards the road here. What was off to the left here that is now just charred boards?
Off to the left was we called it a Sunday school room, but we had used it for it was overflow. We had big funerals, so we would overflow. These two windows here that are off on the left-hand side, they would open up, and you would be able to sit 20 to 30 people in there. We pack them in like sardines, of course. When you fit them in there, they will be able to hear the service and be a part of the congregation. And then we would change that over. In January, we were coming right from Christmas. We had a rotating Christmas tree there. So that became a room where it was just decorated, and people would go in there and sit and talk and have refreshments and things like that.
Reverend Perez has given into the harsh reality that this structure is going to have to be, as he puts it, laid to rest in the coming weeks. But there is a part of the building that was saved by the firefighters who came to battle the blaze, and it will be the new home of this tight-knit congregation, and they're hoping to get it open for the looming 135th anniversary of this parish. But until then, Reverend Perez and his congregation are worshiping a few miles down the road at the very quaint Metropolitan Methodist Church. It was there that we talked about how the community is holding up with all these recent brushes with fire and tragedy.
The community is different because Whitesville has changed over the years. Many people have moved out. We have a lot of abandoned houses. We have a lot of empty rows where the town used to be. And so it was this eerie place where you had a lot of people coming to mourn the church, but yet you don't have a lot of people in the community that come to our church any longer. And so we had to remember those things of what had happened, but also we had to dream about what's going to happen next. Where would we be next time, if there is a next time? Right. And so I think the opportunity for us at first was to mourn what we've lost, but then it was the thought process of, what do we do tomorrow? Do we keep on mourning, or do we pick ourselves up and start something new? And I think that's probably what the congregation and I think the people were looking for is what happens now. And then the thought process was, well, God makes all things new. So let's find out what is going to happen that's going to be positive out of all of this. Yeah. Some of us just have looked at all that's going on the Eastern Shore and just have given up. You know, when you look around and you see a lot of empty buildings, you look around and see where neighbors used to be and where places used to be live and you had people running around and kids playing through the streets, and now it's just an empty echo. You know, that sort of strikes you as, you know, am I going to be the last person in this pew? Am I going to be the last person, you know, to understand, you know, the history of this church? Mm-hmm. And then you have others who do dream a new dream, who see how God is working to make things new and are willing and encouraged to reach out and step up and do some things. And I think the arsonist fire just sort of does both of that. It makes us look at the buildings that once were occupied and that are no longer, and we wonder, you know, is something going to happen with this, or is this just going to be a faded ghost town pretty soon?
That was Reverend Carl Perez, the pastor of the Adams United Methodist Church in Whitesville, Virginia.
We move now from Accomack County, Virginia, to Crisfield, Maryland, where the tiny community has been diligently rebuilding and rebounding from the damages incurred by Superstorm Sandy since the storm blew through in late October. But Crisfield got some good news recently. They won approval for a 750-kilowatt wind turbine from the Maryland Board of Public Works. So joining me to talk about this is Noah Bradshaw. He's the city inspector in Crisfield. Noah, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Brian. It's good to talk to you.
So let's talk first about the town before we talk about the turbine that's going to be spinning above it. How are things in Crisfield today?
Well, it's still here. We're still functioning. We're, you know, it's the old thing, like I say, it's hard to keep a good town down. We just go back to work when the water goes down. we've got most of the streets have been cleaned off. We still got a few trees laying down and remnants that will be, they're unsightly. They'll get taken care of, though, as we evolve. The biggest thing was getting people out of harm's way. I think that has pretty well been accomplished. And we're now in the process of either still mucking out, which is, you know, stripping the houses out, getting the mold and mildew out of it. A lot of that has already been, you know, finished, and now they're drying out and trying to get the crews back in to actually start putting the houses back together. And we do have a couple faith-based groups that are in here working, and that blows you away that this many people will show up to volunteer their services. And it's sort of a godsend, and we just, you know, no one realizes it until something like this happens when you're right in the middle of it. It's wonderful. The Mennonites are coming in. They are wanting to build new houses for people. That's what their specialty is. REMCOR is the United Methodist Committee on Disaster Relief. They are here full-time also, and we expect to see them around a year and a half to 2 years that these folks will be in here. Other groups are coming in also, and we have, of course, set up our case manager through the Long-Term Recovery Committee for Somerset County mm-hmm. in Crisfield, and that is right adjacent to City Hall here, right on the other side of the parking lot, and he is now, we're working closely with him, trying to feed him all the information he needs so he can actually make decisions and help people go through the process of recovering their homes and getting them back in their house. So it's a major job. It's just, but every case is different. Everyone has to be worked on individually, and that's where we are. We're in that process. People are some have settled in, already gone back in their homes. The housing authority is fixed up pretty well. We've just about got the final inspections done over there, but everybody's being taken care of, and that's the good news.
Yeah. Are you confident that as we move into the warm summer months and Crisfield prepares for another summer season, that all the businesses and everything will be kind of up and running and running at full capacity?
I think that's a true statement that, right now we have maybe one that isn't open, but he has chosen not to be open, but he probably will later in the as the season gets here. But I don't know of any business that really closed. Some of them relocated to a higher ground, if you will, in the city to other places, newer, fresher places. But we have a couple that normally Sandy didn't cause the issues. A couple of them, it just situation is they're not making it, so they disappear. Something else comes in, takes its place. So we haven't seen a net decrease. Probably got a couple extra ones in here, small businesses that are coming, and we expect more. It's just a matter of putting it all back together. But the businesses are functioning, and they were functioning a couple days after. Some of them, they just cleaned it out and kept serving.
So let's talk about the wind turbine, 750-kilowatt wind turbine. It's going to be powering your sewage plant. I know this has been something you've been working on for several years. Tell me about the project itself and how you're feeling now that it's finally going to come to fruition.
Oh, it's exhilarating because we've worked so hard to get it done, and it just takes a lot of paperwork, a lot of pushing things through to get through all these hoops, and we still have to break ground and get it going, but that's in the process. Hopefully within 30 days we should have that going. The engineering firm that we awarded it to is doing most of that, so it's gotten off our back because we can only do so much and still keep the city running. They're doing a good job, and they've awarded it, so we're ready to go. You know, the fear is that the day we get it up, the wind will never blow again.
but
I don't think that's the case at Crisfield.
That's very true. You know, I've seen statistical estimations that say that you guys could be saving as much as $150,000 to $200,000 with this wind turbine.
Yes.
This is the way that it's set up, and I explain this for people. This will only power the sewage plant, even though the wind turbine may make extra energy than what the sewage plant needs. You would essentially be selling that back to the grid. Explain that for people.
The term selling implies that it's being sold. It goes back to the grid because all the power has to go to the grid, so it's regulated and then comes back to us. So it's like our power going out there to be on the system and coming back, and there's a slight overcharge they pick up, you know, for that service, because you can't have fluctuating current. You don't want that going anywhere. So that's a process. It's all set up, and the equipment boxes do all that for you. As far as the excess, the estimates are based on what we are spending today on energy for that wastewater treatment plant alone. It will generate potentially up to 10% more energy than we use. We don't know that, you know, until you see it actually in operation and see what's going on. But if it does, then that money just sits there in the account. It's called zero net metering type thing. It just is a credit back toward future bills, because you still have to have power, because you have different times, day, night. You never know where the energy level is going to be, and if it is not blowing one day for some reason, not giving enough energy out of it, you still have to have your power.
And speaking with some folks down there, last time I was there, I believe it was said to me that putting a wind turbine in Crisfield is an absolute no-brainer based on the aforementioned wind that we spoke about. Talk about what, you know, the presence of a wind turbine could mean as far as the message that it sends about where Crisfield is headed in the future.
I've been telling the business folks even that to get ready, because people are coming to town to build this thing. So you've got an influx of people that need a place to sleep, need a place to eat, entertainment, all that's coming. They're going to be, take a good 9 to 10 months to get this thing going, along with the other construction and reconstruction of things that we have here. That's given a shot in the arm to the city, and it will bring, you know, anytime you're building something, there's money floating all around it. And also because it's a great story. It's a great story for the state when we actually are capturing, you know, the wind and turning it into energy and saving that money that we could possibly apply, and we haven't seen it yet, so we don't want to spend it before we get it. But we could use it to fill up potholes, for instance, or reduce taxes, or many, many things can be done with it, but we have to get it first.
We've been speaking with Noah Bradshaw. He's the city inspector in Crisfield, Maryland. Noah, always nice to talk to you, and thanks for joining me here on Coastal Connection.
Good talking to you.
To learn more, click to our website, wamucoast.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm Brian Russo.